Makes it easier to see the screen.
Oh, okay.
All right, let's go ahead and get started here. Glad you could all be here. Welcome. We have, first of all, some minutes. Somebody want to?
I make a motion and we approve the minutes of the last meeting.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. And is there a motion about a treasurer?
I'd like to move that we amend the agenda so that we add the election of treasurer to the agenda.
I second.
Approve?
I approve.
Okay. And we're doing that
right now.
Do we have a...
And I'd like to make a motion that John Correa be appointed as treasurer.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Done. Okay, I think that's the only things that we need to get through. We have our work session planned for next time. We're excited to be able to have a report from Patty Gray today on mental health issues in Clark County. We have been getting lots of information in the paper recently, which has been wonderful to see what is or is not going on in relationship to mental health issues in Clark County. And Patty has been involved in this arena for quite some time. So Patty, take it away.
Well, my name is Patty Gray. I'm a registered nurse. I claim 30 years of experience. I stopped counting after 30. I am board certified in gerontology. So as I'm speaking to you today, I'm speaking as a generalist. Mental illness and mental health are not my specialties, but they certainly are topics and issues that I encounter in my practice every single day. And just life in general. My purpose today is to really just begin this dialogue as it relates to mental health for the aging population. And this is just a jumping off point. Our Committee on Mental Health has had two brief meetings, and we are just in the stage of getting going. I actually felt really encouraged by the response to the article in the Columbian and the Senior Messenger, because I did have people reach out by phone and email and indicate that they would like to participate in that committee. And so that was really heartening to see that there's interest out there. My presentation is going to be geared to lay people. So if there are there mental health professionals in the audience, I may not use the terms and may not be as technical as you would be, but it's my intention just to kind of lay this out in general and talk about where we are and where we could be. I know more about what we don't have than I do about our existing resources, because that in my day-to-day work is where the rub comes, is when there's a big gap between what is needed and what's available. I want to acknowledge the current members of the Mental Health Committee for the Commission on Aging. I'm going to describe mental health and the importance to the community, outline some of the illness categories. I'm going to share with you what for me were very surprising statistics as it relates to elderly suicide, and also review some national, regional, state, and local statistics and benchmarks. And hopefully some of you will be recruited to working on this committee through this presentation. So we started out, we have just a small group to start with and hope to grow. Scott Perlman has served on that committee. Lisa Rasmussen is also a Commission on Aging member, and she serves on that committee. Mark Majorio, he's with the Americans Building Community. And also Peggy McCarthy from NAMI, which is the from our Clark County chapter, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. And Peggy is a very, very knowledgeable resource in this arena. We were thrilled to have her involvement. You know, we all know what physical health is, or at least we know what it is, particularly when we realize we've taken it for granted. And that's when our physical health starts slipping. That's when we realize how important it is. But I don't think as a society we stop and think about what mental health really is. Just a brief definition of what it means to be healthy mentally. You have the ability to enjoy your life. You have resilience. That doesn't mean that things don't happen, but it means that you have the ability to bounce back from events that occur and from stresses. You have balance. And by balance, in this definition, it means that you're a social being and you enjoy social interaction, and you balance that too with all of our human need for solitary time as well. So there's a balance between the social being and the solitary being. We all like to be self-actualized, and by that I mean we like to think that we're making the most of our talents and our gifts and that we can live up to our potential. It does take that to be a mentally healthy human being. We have the ability to form healthy relationships. And we possess self-esteem, have a healthy sexuality, and have healthy coping skills dealing with loss and death. So if you're mentally healthy, then these are characteristics that you possess. So mental illness categories. I'm not going to read you the whole list, but the categories generally are anxiety disorders, and those are things like panic and phobia. Behavioral disorders, the one we read about the most, particularly as it relates to younger people, ADHD. That's not to say that older people don't suffer from that, but that's in the category of behavioral disorder. There are eating disorders. Substance use disorders are mental illnesses. Mood disorders like bipolar, which can be either type 1 or type 2. Seasonal affective disorder and self-harm. There are personality disorders. You'll hear those described as someone is antisocial or they have a borderline personality. Psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia and suicidal behavior falls into the category of mental illness. You know, as a society, we've largely moved past stigmatizing people for physical ailments. Aside from age, we do still stigmatize people for age and ailments associated with age. It wasn't long ago that people with epilepsy, which is a physical condition, were shunned or whispered about or thought to be possessed. And we now know with medical science that there are biological reasons for a disease like epilepsy. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember, but I can remember that when someone in my grandmother's neighborhood would receive a cancer diagnosis, that she would whisper, she'd just whisper the word, as if it had to be a secret, that if you said it out loud, it might be contagious. And I think as a society, we've gotten past that being a social stigma, and we recognize that we're not going to get it by saying it out loud. And in fact, we do come together as a community to help people with cancer, and we're much more public about that diagnosis. Diabetes was also a very stigmatized physical illness in that it was sort of hush-hush, and if it ran in your family, that was a secret. And some people viewed that disease as being somehow not strong enough willpower-wise to stay away from the things that would cause you problems. And we know now that that's not at all the case, that it's a biochemical issue. So that kind of thing is no longer a big family secret, and we accept it as a society. But there's still a societal stigma about mental illnesses, even though we know from science that they stem from biological factors, from injuries, from brain trauma, from brain chemistry, and sometimes from traumatic experiences in life, or even the hand that we were dealt genetically. But our society doesn't like to acknowledge these conditions, and therefore we do not devote the resources to mental illness that we devote to physical illness. Well, maybe it's not a big deal then, you know, if we're just getting by. But if you start looking at statistics, we're kind of like the ostriches putting our heads in the sand about this. 1 in 5 American adults experienced a mental health issue, and that issue did not resolve, but only 38% of American adults received treatment.
Wow.
1 in 10 young people experienced a period of major depression, and only 20% of those were treated. 1 in 20 Americans live with a serious mental disorder, which affects their everyday functioning in life, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression. And most startling, I guess, to me, was that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. It's more than double the number of homicides that we have in our country. But you wouldn't know that by listening to the news, or reading online, or any of the daily news reports. And yet, when we treat mental illness, we have highly effective methods. And the results are wonderful. We get higher overall productivity. We get better educational outcomes. We get lower crime rates, stronger economies. It lowers healthcare costs, improves quality of life, not only for the individual that has the mental illness, but for the family and friend unit that's supporting them. It increases lifespan, and it certainly improves family life. But we're slow and we're low. The resources we devote to mental illnesses tend to be reactionary. We don't devote resources until we're in a crisis. Mental health resources and interventions are severely underfunded, and in the past have very arbitrary limits. If you had a funding source, such as insurance, you had limits placed on how much mental health access you would have. We're starting to see some changes, so I don't want to be all gloom and doom. And I think it was a long time coming, but in 2013, the Parity Act was passed, and the Affordable Care Act, regardless of your political persuasion or not, has within it requirements that when health insurance coverage is offered, mental health and substance use disorder benefits cannot be more restrictive than healthcare benefits. So your co-payments can't be higher. The limits on services that you use, I don't know how many of you ever looked at your policy, but if you looked at your policy a couple of years ago, it probably said you could have 10 visits a year, 15, maybe if you were really lucky, 20. And the criteria for managing that care or for overseeing your utilization cannot be more strict than it is for physical health issues. So it's great that we're making progress in this regard. This mandate may actually make our problem worse for a while, because we're going to have more people who are able to access mental health services, but we haven't kept up in terms of staffing for those issues. There is quite a scarcity of mental health resources, and I can tell you that anecdotally from my clients and from the families that I work with in my everyday practice. We don't have nearly enough mental health practitioners, counselors, psychiatrists, and they're not trained and available to meet the existing need. We need to start benchmarking where we're at now and seeing if we're going to make progress. We've done that for a number of years for physical health services. For instance, in 2010, Clark County participated with other counties and measured the availability of health care and found that in our population in Clark County, 77.3% of our citizens were able to access health care within 14 days, generally an average. But we have no known benchmark for mental health services, and I can tell you anecdotally that it can take months and months and months. You're probably reading in the paper a lot of stories as it relates to the Affordable Care Act and other changes that have gone on in the healthcare system. You're hearing a lot about the scarcity of primary care physicians. We're experiencing that in our county as well, especially for our elderly citizens, those who are counting on Medicare to cover them. But we need to start measuring the access that we have with mental health services as well. I'm going to describe two scenarios for you, and I will say to you that as a country and as a state and even as a county, we're not doing that well in dealing with this mental health dilemma. This is a real life situation, a very caring and involved family, a lifetime for the client of developmental disability, and the family going through a journey of over 10 years looking for assistance. This individual was incarcerated for threats and assaults 4 times in 19 months because he found himself in situations where he wasn't able to cope adequately. He was deemed incompetent by Western State Hospital during his first incarceration. So the first time he was arrested and charged, he was evaluated and couldn't be found guilty because he didn't have the mental capacity to make these decisions. Well, over the next 2 years, he was hospitalized over 100 times, admitted and released, admitted and released, admitted and released. His family continued to try to find resources for him. He was excluded from getting resources from developmental disabled programs because of a technicality having to do with his diagnosis, and also from the perspective of his IQ being average. So in other words, his IQ was too high, and yet he doesn't have these daily coping skills that he needs to have to be a contributing member of society. Emergency mental health services requested that the family stop calling. They actually said, stop calling us. We can't help you. You're bugging us. I'm putting words in their mouth. They probably didn't say you're bugging us, but that was the clear message, was stop calling. The predicted outcome for this individual will be homelessness, most likely injury to other people, and not so unlikely death. So let me tell you about another scenario. A caring, involved family, a lifetime of developmental disability, 10 years of seeking assistance, and then finally, in a sort of desperate move, establishing the individual with their own residence, Within 48 hours, this individual was picked up by the police, brought to an inpatient psychiatric unit where application for disability services was initiated, and transferred to the state hospital where those services, the both disability and mental health services, were approved within 90 days. This individual is now living a very structured and supported life, successful. There'll be bumps in the road along the way, but without this help, his situation would have been homelessness, injury to others, and death. I'm wondering if anybody would like to guess which scenario was Clark County. Well, I'm sad to tell you that is the first scenario. But I can encourage you and tell you that there are ways to get this right, because the second scenario is the same client going over the river to Oregon. So we can do better. Right now, the way we're handling things, we're really straining the resources that we have. We're taking up space and resources from law enforcement, from the jails. We're depleting the coping mechanisms of families in the community. We're accessing the healthcare system and hospitals in a way that they're not equipped to handle. We're taxing our county and state mental health agencies. Nonprofit social services are doing as much as they can. And employers are paying a price for our undealt with issues as well. You know, mental illness is pretty non-discriminatory. It doesn't matter what ethnicity, it doesn't matter what social strata you come from, financial situation, it crosses all lines. Now, I got involved in the mental health committee because I was fascinated or surprised by the suicide statistics for elderly people. So I want to talk a little bit about that. That's how Bill roped me in to being on this committee. I had some experiences with clients that caused me to start seeking out some information about depression and suicide in older adults. And I was really surprised to find out that this is a growing cause of death for boomers and for elders. I have, frankly, maybe I should be embarrassed because, gerontology is what I do, but I had a tendency to think of suicide as more of a younger disease. And I think that's because that is when we see it in the media, is when it involves a young person. And that's certainly a huge tragedy to the community and a huge loss. But so too is losing someone with 85 years of life experience because they've grown hopeless. In 2012, nationally, the highest suicide rate was among 45 to 59-year-olds. It was 19.88 people per 1,000. It surprised me that the baby boomers were up there so high. And the second highest suicide rate occurred in 78 individuals that were 75 and older. In our country, there's one senior committing suicide every 96 minutes.
My goodness.
There are 15 senior suicides per day. Now, I said that suicide that mental illness doesn't discriminate, but suicide does seem to discriminate to some extent. The highest risk category are white males over 65. And as you approach 85, your risk goes up exponentially. 83.5% of the suicides are male. Males over 65 commit suicide five times the rate of females. The female rate declines after age 60. And the other thing about senior suicide is that seniors who commit suicide or attempt it are much, much, much more successful than folks in other age groups. 1 in 4 attempts is successful versus other age groups, it's 1 to 100 or 1 to 200. So when seniors decide to commit suicide or talk about it or think about it, it's a very serious intention. And one of the leading causes of suicide among seniors is depression, which goes untreated and undiagnosed. And I've had on many occasions had to struggle with poor physicians. I don't pick on them today, but that's what nurses do. We pick on doctors. But I've had to struggle with doctors who seem to feel that depression is a normal part of aging, and it's not. It's treatable. And it's a tragedy that we don't take it more seriously. I know this slide is a little bit hard to see, but the green box, it's divided by age groups, and the green box is suicide. So you see that it's quite a leading cause of death in our young population, but it remains in the top 10 causes of death, even as we age. Suicide also seems to discriminate a bit by what region of the country you live in.
Wow.
I guess we're lucky we don't live in Wyoming or Montana, but we do live in the region with the second highest suicide rate in the country. So if we look at our statistics and how we compare to the state, we're still comparing ourselves to a high range. In Clark County, suicide is the fourth leading cause of death. So more people die of suicide than they do chronic lung disease, and that's from a 2008 report. I suspect that the rest of the country's been trending up in all age groups, and we probably will as well. You know, this is a big challenge. It's a big, wide area. It's a lot like tackling the whole healthcare system. It's pretty complicated. But our committee does have goals. We'd like to engage county, city, law enforcement, citizens, and mental and medical health providers to take specific steps. We'd like to see access improved, cost effectiveness improved, and make sure that the services that are provided are efficacious. We'd like to increase community-based and inpatient psychiatric resources and responsiveness and the number and availability of inpatient beds. Many, many of our mentally ill are being housed in the jails because we have no room for them. We'd like to see an increased contribution on the part of local, regional, and national healthcare providers. We are fortunate. We live in a community where we have Legacy Health System, we have Peace Health, and we have Kaiser Permanente, and we'd like to see those health systems band together and come up with a more unified approach to how mental health and physical health are intersecting. We'd certainly like to see a reduction in the use of the county jail and also the emergency room, because these are not appropriate places for mental health treatment. Clark County can do so much better. There's a well-established national prevention strategy. It outlines lots of steps that can be taken. We'd like to see a very specific and actionable local strategy. I do have a clipboard in the back if anyone wants to sign up to participate on the committee. just leave your name and email, phone number. That would be much appreciated. These are just a few of the places that have information. I would welcome any questions, comments.
Here you go, Patty.
Well, I'm Elizabeth Compton, and I suffer from bipolar disorder. And I was in Plumwood Mental Health for 16 years.
I'm Elizabeth Compton, and I have bipolar disorder. And I was in Plumwood for 16 years. And I had a job, and they decided, oh, you're well. You don't need your services anymore. And then I worked at the job for 3.5 years, and they decided that they wanted me to work full-time, and they laid me off. And I've been unemployed since January, trying to find a job, and I can't find a job. And they took me off of it, Social Security. I'm trying to get back on Social Security. I have no income. And the only reason I'm not homeless is because I'm on Section 8 housing and they're paying my rent. And I've been very symptomatic since then, you know. And the only thing that's keeping me alive is my family. I have a grandchild and, you know, my faith in God. And I'm just, and where I was working, I had no support system whatsoever. There's just so much I want to say. Clark County doesn't have good mental health services, you know. It has a lot of work to do. And right now I'm seeing a really good counselor at Lutheran Community Services. And anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thank you. You're an example of we give help in a reactive way, but not in a way that, you know, was able to sustain you. And I'm sorry for the struggles that you're going through. Thank you for sharing it with us.
And I have a suggestion. NAMI has a lot of different support groups.
They connect.
Okay. Well, for other people in the room, you know.
Get your mic. Let's see.
Oh. So,
can you stand up?
Yes, I'll be happy to.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, I'm Ann Donnelly, and I'm president of NAMI Southwest Washington. And our executive director, Peggy McCarthy, will be serving on your committee. And we're very dedicated to all of the objectives that you just laid out. And with regard to Elizabeth, she's a very typical client of ours because we do offer support groups for family. We would welcome her family. Her brother is very supportive of her. We would welcome him to come in and attend our family-to-family support groups. And I've given her our contact information, and she can come in and we can assist her. We can't wave a magic wand, but we can provide consistent support for the issues that she's raised. So I just want everyone to know that NAMI Southwest Washington is deeply committed to everything that you've talked about. And sadly, I have to go to another meeting related to this, but I wanted to come tell you how important this is.
Thank you.
So I just want to add one thing to let you guys know, because, you know, we talked about we only have 20 mental health beds in Clark County, well, in Vancouver area, that inpatient, and the criteria to get into those is extremely daunting. And when you think about our population and the statistics, having only 20 available beds to help family, but especially the people that are suffering, is very sad for our community.
Hi, my name is Chris Roger. I moved into this state in February from the South, and I've been dealing with general psychiatry for 5 years in the South, 12 counties with a general psychiatrist down there. I am currently with Southwest Washington Behavioral Health. We fund programs like NAMI and all of our mental health systems for the adult care. Because of my concerns as an executive, I've not in an executive position in Texas, but have held executive mental health positions at the state level, the local level, for about 30 years now, with serious mental illness. And I was part of the initiation in the state of Wisconsin that deinstitutionalized in the 70s. So that was a different population. Those were warehouse people. Those were people who had gone through lobotomies and things we had seen in the 50s and 40s. So I come from an institutionalized system of building care for the last 30 years in our state and community local centers. I am now in the state of Washington, and I'm also concerned, just as you, about the aging of our population. There is the Alliance for Children and Families, who speaks of the aging of our population as a serious trend overall in this country. And when you speak of the aging of our population, it includes our mental health systems. I would challenge anyone in here who does not encounter a mental health issue in their family system or extended family someplace. You may have a child with ADHD, a niece with depression, an uncle who has a substance abuse disorder, a family domestic violence, anger, and personality issues. There is not one family, including mine, that if I look at your extended family, I will find a behavioral or mental health issue. So it affects us all. And I serve my community and to my family members and to the members of my community, because we all are afflicted with this. I want to touch on the senior, Gerald Psychiatric, with some more information. I'm amazed, Patty, at your presentation tonight. You have touched something so crucial, and if we don't deal with this, our systems are in the worst crisis in 5 to 10 years. There is a movement right now in Washington, a bill in Washington, D.C., proposed by, I believe, a representative in Oregon, to try and get even more mental health professionals allowed on Medicare. Right now, Medicare is limited to the professional limits or provincial credentials of who can provide mental health under Medicare. We are trying to get to say, can you add a master's level, master's mental counselor, master's LMFT, marriage and family therapist. These are things, a licensed clinical social worker we can get on Medicare. But if we could extend Medicare to allow more because of the provider shortage. So there's a bill, and you can look for that. And we're trying to get Medicare. This is a Medicare issue. This is a silo issue between the government funding sources. This is an issue of, you mentioned jails and ERs. We are now putting mental health systems in the courtrooms. These are where the mentally ill have ended up because of our failures in our systems. The aging of the seniors is anxiety, depression, and schizophrenia. Geriatric psychiatrists, our aging population will double to 70 million by 2030, but our geriatric psychiatrists are expected to decrease as they resign and retire. So we will be adding, I believe the number is 2,000 new geriatric psychiatrists by 2030 to handle a doubling of the elderly, but at the same time, we will be losing 2,400 geriatric psychiatrists. So we gain nothing. Medicare is also driving our providers away by reimbursement rates. Providers cannot afford to sustain a practice on our reimbursement rates, and this is again a federal Medicare issue. The statistics will rise with the aging of the baby boomers. The adult physical conditions of aging also contribute to mental health, and we need our family practitioners to recognize physical conditions contribute to depression, contribute to anxiety, contribute to the other disorders that some of these people suffer privately. I have gone into homebound situations using grant monies to put therapists in homes because the elderly could not get to an office. They were severely isolated and severely homebound. And when I got in there in Nueces County in Texas, and we went into about 8 homes for a year, I asked the therapist to show me all of those case files so I could see what trend was happening out there. And the thing I found out there, out of these 8 elderly, some were 60, I think 70, 80, they all had depression, anxiety, they were very isolated, and they were homebound as defined by the city. But the thing that struck me most, that they were truly alone. I could not find any extended family for these people. Another if they had extended family, it might mean so far away this extended daughter or whatever could not assist. So one of my concerns when we did bring into the home with the person with mental illness was their true isolation in these illnesses. Hence your suicide rate. Hence, I also am aware of substance abuse in those homes. Right now, there's a movement in Washington, D.C. to integrate physical care with mental health care. That's to be done very soon. It is to come under the same parity as you're discussing, but that leads us to question what managed care organizations will come in here and manage mental health. So the mental health dollars of Medicare and Medicaid will be coming in and not under a behavioral health umbrella. They will soon come in under a managed care umbrella and handled by managed care companies. And we're concerned about that because your decisions will not be at your local level.
Wow.
Some of the issues, again, of the seniors in their home is, you know, family. The primary caregivers in the United States right now are family members. You'll find that over and over. Primary caregivers in our families throughout the station is not your nursing homes. It's your caregivers or your family members, and primarily adult women and daughters are our primary caregivers in the home. Our providers are stretched to the limits. We are dealing with substance abuse in the elderly as well, and a multiplicity of prescriptions and things that are not being effectively monitored. And there's a couple other issues I'll present, and then I'll be quiet. There are a number of issues that you haven't even thought about yet. The senior, which we call the World War II or silent generation, prior to the baby boomers, they were the first generation, including my parents, who did not institutionalize their son with Down syndrome. They kept him at home. And at that time, when my brother was kept at home, there was no, they were too institutionalized, my brother. My parents, father is now 95. I have a Down syndrome brother under the care of a 95-year-old senior. There are many in that silent generation who were the first generation as my parents to not institutionalize their children in our state systems. And now as they age, we have a silent generation of disabled adults, middle age, in these homes that are about to enter the mental health system, just as my brother. The other thing is we have a population of mentally ill adults who were the first people brought out of the state institutions in the 70s and 80s. They are now in their 60s and 70s. They have endured 30, 40 years of hospitalizations, acute psychiatric care, and psychotropic medication. They are about to age into our senior population. And the most appalling fact of the mental illness with any age group in our nation is because of the disparity in health care, they die at a much earlier rate than you or I. I wanted to present to you some other information about our senior community.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I hope you will consider that clipboard in the back.
Hello, I'm Bradley. And I have been a caregiver for my wife for well over 20, 25 years. And I'm glad to see that there's other advocates here. I didn't expect to see much. But my wife and Lisa left for a reason, because right now, she's under a court-ordered guardianship. My sister did a little illegal number. She went to have it back. I've had a first year power attorney for my wife for some time. And I've always taken care of her. When I'm there, she's calm, I keep her stable, but she had misdiagnosed originally, and she had mistreated with electroshock therapy and misprescribed with drugs. and I'm trying to get a facility down in Phoenix, Arizona that will essentially have been successful in getting people off of on these kind of medications, like essentially this doctor, Dr. Libby, was been very successful, and he went into the state prison system and he selectively chose several patients for a demo. And he wound up taking a bunch of patients out. That's the exact count number. I don't know how many he took out, but it was enough. He treated them all, and the state recognized that they were cured. And they didn't have to go back into the mental health system. They didn't have to go back into the state prison system. But this is classified as alternative care, alternative medication. We cannot have that. We can have drugs. We can basically treat these cycles and whatnot with these drugs. And my wife was grieving for the loss of her mother, who died from pancreatic cancer. And her father wasn't really that supportive. He didn't recognize that she was grieving for the loss of her mother. She was essentially a mama's girl and traded basically tired to April strings. But he eventually died from colon cancer. And she got no support from her brother, who is an airline captain, eventually after retiring from the Navy, fighter pilot, and totally different to her. He's screamed at her a number of times. And when I asked him about this, he denied it. And yet he screamed at me too. It had zero effect on me, because I've dealt this with a stepfather who's a sociopath. Okay? And I've dealt with the issue also because I used to work down shipyards. Frequently a lot of mental patients and bigger guys than myself work it down. So I don't want to take up any more of your time. I thank you for the amount of time you allowed me to speak, but I think we should look at alternative care, as opposed to the failed drug system that's sponsored by the AMA. Okay?
Thank you, Bradley.
And the organization down there is called Trivia. The founder and the director at the time was Dr. Libby. He has since passed on, but he has other doctors in place now.
Thank you.
I thank you.
Hi, you guys. My name is Greg Moulton. One of the hats that I wear is that I set up the Public Health Advisory Council. And on the council and the public health, we're currently looking at how we impact ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, within our county, because we know that that leads to a whole lot of chronic health issues in older adults. Obviously, mental health is a part of that. And there's a lot of people in our council that are hot on the mental health issue. And so I just wanted to suggest for you guys to ponder, and I'm going to be running off to our public health meeting here in a couple minutes, but perhaps maybe later in the spring, since we meet on the same evenings, we could have a joint session between Public Health Council and between the Commission on Aging to talk about mental health, because really we're after the same thing.
Yeah.
And so that might, when you guys get together, you can talk about that, and then I'll share that idea with our meeting tonight, so we'll be talking about. We're just in the plan-making phase of the entire thing, so, something to think about.
That's a great idea, Greg. So.
Greg, that's excellent. That's the kind of connection that we're hoping to make in our meetings here.
Perfect.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, one of the other hats I wear is home health, and I'm a physical therapist, and so many people that I see at the very end of all their diagnosis codes is a little 311 down at the bottom, which is depression, and it's... Everybody I see has that little code. I'm surprised I don't see it. It's a huge issue. And I'm glad we're looking at it.
Anyone else? We'll Patty, thank you very, very much. Is there anything else you want to say in response to any of this?
No, I appreciate good attendance. I can tell this is an issue that we all have a strong commitment to addressing. And thank you very much.
You know, I heard a statistic, Greg, relationship to something you just said. At a session this last week, a guy was saying the state of Washington 2007 reports that of kids entering kindergarten, 38% had been traumatized already. I mean, 4 out of 10, 40%. And that significantly impacts the brain. You know, you go through all the brain research that we have now and the gray matter shrinks with highly stressful events that Emily Ansel studies at Yale 2012, you know, all the MRI stuff that she did that shows how significant stress impacts gray matter and so forth. And so you realize this, all this goes someplace, it adds up. And so thank you for your comments. Thank you so much, everybody, for your comments. Yes?
I apologize for coming in late. I'm taking a card to the second director of NAMI and South.
Wait, we'll get you a mic.
Okay.
We can't have you without a mic.
Thank you. My voice is starting to fail. I'm Penny McCarthy. I'm the executive director of NAMI in Southwest Washington. And I don't know if Patty mentioned anything about
the
school program.
And Donnelly just left. No, go ahead and talk.
Okay. Well, you know, we're working with Vancouver Public Schools and Vancouver Housing Authority. And we had hoped to get the program started in the fall, but it's been pushed back to spring, and it actually won't roll out until next fall. But we're working with a VISTA volunteer on this. And are you aware of this program? So we will be working in three schools in Vancouver that have the highest rates of absenteeism. And so absenteeism rates are indicative of who's going to graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early grades, more than 10 days of absenteeism reduce a child's chance of graduating from high school. But we also know that kids who are absent from school also live in homes that are poverty ridden. There are lots of traumas in those homes. And some work that I did in my previous company, we knew that the kids who were absent from school often either had their own mental health diagnoses by that time or lived in families with mental health diagnoses. And so what we're going to be doing family to families and basics classes in the apartment buildings where most of these kids live, or in the schools, and we'll be working with the families to decide where the best places for our NAMI signature classes to be. But we're also creating a new program, and we just got some funding to do part of it, and so we're in the process of developing a resiliency training program now for parents to teach them more skills and resiliency to help their kids learn to be more resilient. And then hopefully we'll get some additional funding before the end of this year, and we'll be building the other half of that, which is a resiliency skills building course for small children. So the kids who are having these traumas in their early life and are, you know, we need to figure out how to better protect them and give them the skills that they need to get through a life that's often full of trauma. But we've started using the ACEs surveys in our support groups at the jail and in the ones that we do around the three counties where we serve. And our mental health clients often have 5 to 10 ACEs in their lives. It's just horrifying. And we're starting to educate the adults about ACEs so that they can be thinking, oh my goodness, if I have children, you know, this is going to mount up for them if they experience the same things I do. So I was really pleased to hear about the ACEs and the concern in the community about the ACEs. So thank you very much.
Anybody else? And this is an exciting evening, don't you think? I'm so glad that you all have chosen to come and be a part of this. I hope that you will take seriously Patty's invitation to become a part of a group that is moving forward talking about this. We need all the participation we can get in this. And especially when you read about the potential of even shrinking those 20 beds, Lisa, to less. And, you know,
shrinking
them. Yeah, with the having less of them.
That it's, and we haven't even talked about January 1st. Emergency rooms will not be allowed to keep anybody longer than 12 hours. And so what that means is they either go on the street or they go to jail, but most of the time they're going to go on the street, and there is no revolving door for these guys.
So we're going to have to come up with some constructive ways to deal with this. And there's got to be a win-win somewhere in this.
And we're talking about managed care. Is the problem is all of our managed care, except for you might be able to a local one, is all back east. You know, I mean, the case managers, the last I heard, were handling not locally, like at SWOD, but it's over 300, is it not? Case managers for our elders. For managed care, and that's crazy. They don't even touch, so that goes to the suicide rate and all of you were talking about.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we're really in crisis mode and have been for quite some time. It's just that it's not recognized and publicized.
Well, we've got a lot to work on in our community now, don't we? Sounds to me like this is something that we've got to spend a significantly greater amount of time on with what we have. Okay, is there anything else that we need to discuss tonight? I don't think so.
Well, my approval of the plan.
The work plan?
Yeah.
Didn't we already do that?
No.
I make a motion that we approve our work plan as it was emailed to everybody and corrected here today.
I second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Amen. Opposed? Okay. Thank you very much for coming, and if you have anybody you want to have discussion with, please stay and do that.
And may I announce that I put flyers back here? We're doing a workshop on beating the holiday blues at our office. There are flyers back here at Social Community.
Can you record that, or what's the point to that?